Hi, this is Karen Harvey, and you're listening to Fashion Tech Forum in the studio.
People love to hashtag us when they're wearing something that's Kate Spade. We have a novelty group that is wonderful in that they love our novelty bags so much. They know the product better than our designers. Like, they have been tracking it for years. They've been collecting it for years. And when you have that type of love, I think your job as a marketer is to lean into that and make that really your focus, you know, how you take care of them back.
Jenny Campbell is someone who has successfully taken the idea of taking a leap of faith to the next level. Currently Global Chief Marketing Officer of Kate Spade New York, and someone who I have been very fortunate to get to know and work with, Jenny has embodied the art of combining data, heart, gut instinct, and vision her entire career. Her inherent optimism, positivity, empathy, and tremendous success at companies like Wieden & Kennedy, Nike, 72andSunny, and Tinder were, while not necessarily obvious, a perfect match for a brand like Kate Spade. A brand whose platform is based on the idea that joy colors life. Jenny is someone who I knew instantly lived her life believing in and embodying this important brand DNA from the minute I met her. During our talk, we explore Jenny's special brand of thinking around marketing, where the goal and the work are really about sharing the love that the community gives the brand back with the community. She's always thinking about ways to take care of them in return. Of course, all of this is easier said than done. Jenny's deeply nuanced, heart-infused, and intellectual approach to speaking authentically about joy, positivity, and even mental health is very powerful. And this and many other aspects are what set her apart on the global stage as one of the great marketing leaders driving brands for women today. In our conversation, we also discuss Jenny's background growing up in rural North Carolina and her early love for sports and Nike as a brand. At Nike, she learned so much about creativity and leadership and telling brand stories. She reminds us that it's not just enough to sell something. You need to make people feel something, to create an emotion and an authentic connection in order for consumers to trust you as a brand. This past summer, still in the throes of COVID, Kate Spade released a TikTok campaign garnering over 11 billion views. This was more than an ad. It was pure, uplifting emotion executed impeccably at a time when we all needed some highly connected joy and a heartfelt message of hope, optimism, and love for Kate Spade's hometown of New York City. It clearly struck a chord with Kate Spade's loyal fans, but also with an enormous audience of largely Gen Z TikTok users who really did find joy in the music, dancing, and the message of the video. To make this spot, Kate Spade also utilized the artistic community in New York City, including many Broadway performers who had been out of work for the majority of COVID, while also providing mental health services to those that needed them. For me, this conversation with Jenny was like a breath of fresh air. I hope you equally receive the same dose of inspiration that I did and that it lights up your day a bit, as I know for sure that this conversation is coming at a perfect time as we all move into the holiday season where gratitude and joy are both highly welcomed emotions. I hope you enjoy some good time with your loved ones in this coming holiday season, and thank you again for joining us on Fashion Tech Forum in the studio.
Ha! Exciting. I just had to play my most recent favorite ad campaign.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you so much for making the time. And, you know, I just couldn't be any happier to be here with you. And congratulations, I guess, are in order. Is it a full year now that you're at Kate Spade?
Oh my gosh, you have such a good memory. Yes, like 2 days ago was my 1 year anniversary.
I just had someone print out your CV so I could just say, like, do I have this right? So many things I want to chat with you about today. And did we actually ever meet in person? What it, my brain might right now.
We haven't, you know, but what's so crazy is I feel like I, over these last 2 years, I have so many people that I feel like I know really well that I've actually never met in person. It's crazy the way COVID has done that to us, you know?
It is because, and I think about the people that we helped join companies in 2020 and 2021, and how many of them at such significant and senior level in organizations. I'm just stunned, but I keep thinking that we have met, but of course we haven't. So I guess this is working for us. It's all good. And congratulations on your first year, and talk about making an impact. Sometimes I think about our industry and I realize it takes product so much longer to change, right? The supply chain, just the design process itself, and then actually getting things made, that when we place CEOs or chief merchants, sometimes you can't see the full change because the product takes so long to make and to get into the hands of the consumer. But when we place a global chief marketing officer like yourself, and they come in with a real vision and work with some great partners, as I know you are with Liz, the CEO for Kate Spade, you can see immediately the impact. So I guess what I'd love to do is just ask you to share a little bit about what this first year has been like.
What people can't see, because this is a podcast, I have this huge smile on my face. I can't think of a place I'd more like to be. You know, when you look at your calendar during the day and you're like, ooh, that meeting is going to be hard, or that one's going to be fun. Like, this is the one where I was like, oh, this is going to be good. I get to just talk to Karen for an hour, which is always so nice. Let's think about that. The last year, I've actually been really reflective on it recently because I'm coming up on my anniversary, and it has been an amazing year. Like, Kate Spade as a brand is just in this amazing moment. We have a really strong brand purpose around joy colors life. We have a CEO, Liz Fraser, who you were just mentioning, who is awesome, who just wants to set the world on fire, and is just, when you are a CMO, as my CMO friends will tell you, having a CEO who has big ambition and wants to go, go, go is pretty amazing of an opportunity. So this year has really been, I would not say about reinventing Kate by any means, because Kate Spade has this amazing brand DNA. It has been going back in and going, where is that DNA really strong? How do we double down on it? How do we get that back out there to consumers in a big way? You know, we talk a lot about brand heat as an organization and bringing that back to Kate Spade. We talk a lot about being digital first and consumer first. So this first year has really been around getting that vision reset, getting our strategy set, figuring out how to set the organization up so that we can really explode like a rocket ship. We've had just a lot of fun along the way. We've gotten to make some really amazing work. I'm so proud of the team. I'm so proud of Kate Spade. It's just a fun brand to get to work on.
I am so proud of you.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, man. I think, but it's true. I mean, when we think about you having tangential relationships with the fashion and kind of retail sector, and both with the agencies and of course working at Nike, but like stepping into, I know how hard it is to step into this sector as not having really worked inside in this way before. You had an amazing run at Nike, and we will talk about that at some point, but I just love how bold you stepped into this role. And I did have to play the downtown campaign for myself to get myself in the mood. I love Petula Clark, and I love that song, and seeing Broadway dancers like masked in Washington Square Park made me cry, actually. It was so moving. And this isn't normally where we start, but yeah, it's just where I want to begin. Like, what gave you the inspiration and the courage to step out with something like that? You were probably no more than 5 months, 6 months in when you did that.
I think when I first came into the role, so I came in November of 2020, and I knew I wanted to do a couple things just straight off the bat. The nice thing about coming into this role is this is my second CMO role. And as much as I don't really know the fashion industry, and I had to learn that really fast, at least I wasn't having to learn how to be a CMO, which I had to do in my previous job. And that just takes a little bit longer because it's such a big shift into learning how to do that role. And so in my first like 30 days, I knew I wanted to run fast and hard. And I kind of had learned really where to focus. And big one was I focused a lot on like really getting the brand vision set and articulated in a way within that first 30 days, we could start to shop it around and get people really galvanized around it. And then the second thing was really around team. I spent a lot of time just focusing on my team. Do we have the right people in the right places? Are we set up in the right way so that we can run? And when you focus there, when you first start and you kind of get that solidified, then you really can. You can run. And that's what we did. For the whole second half of my first year, we just started taking that brand vision and the marketing strategy and just started going with it. And I will say, be the first one to say, I have an amazing team. They know this brand. They love this brand. They want to win. And we just started trying some things. We started doubling down on the things that Kate Spade does really, really well. We talk a lot about enabling joy. So we had a lot of conversations like, what does it mean to really enable joy versus just tell people you're about joy? How would you show up as a brand if you were about that? How do we make things that make people really feel, that make them really feel the brand, want to kind of get up and dance with us? And there's so much love and fandom around Kate Spade as a brand too. We really wanted to tap into that. After that, it kind of just, the playbook kind of wrote itself.
It was so moving, I guess, because it was so delicate, I think, that moment in time where we're all still pretty much locked down or things were super limited. It could have gone so wrong. And what we know from your how many million views?
Ooh, that June campaign got 11 billion views on TikToks.
Billion.
Billion. Our stretch goal was 3 billion. We were even blown away at that point.
I had no idea you were at 11 billion. That is just, that just blows my mind. But it was so delicate. Too much joy at a time when people are suffering is actually flies in the face of probably what you're trying, what one is trying to do. And yet that just inspiration or aspiration, just striking that. I mean,
when you lean into something like joy, you have to do it with a really nuanced hand, because if you go really, really literal with joy, you can go into smiley, happy faces, you know, really just kind of fakeness. And one of the things we talk so much about at Kate Spade is this idea of perfectly imperfect. And it's this idea that like, you don't have to be perfect to still have it be amazing. And sometimes putting stuff together in unusual ways, or when you throw stuff together and something isn't right, that actually makes it perfect in its own unrightness. And we did talk a lot about that when we were coming up with the June campaign, because the song itself is a delightful song, but the song is Get Happy. We had a dance number going through the streets of New York. It was, you know, part of the brief for that was really we wanted to write a love letter to New York coming out of this time of lockdown and isolation. But we did. You're exactly right. It was like, how do you do that in the right way? And so we wanted to really pair up how we kind of supported the artistic community with that. So we had found an amazing person, Dylan Pierce, who's a choreographer, who had done this actually, like some initial kind of videos around the same idea. And we were like, oh, Dylan, we want to work with you. And he was so plugged into the artistic community, who had been out of work a lot through COVID, who had really been suffering a lot. And we were able to kind of pair that love letter to New York with really supporting the artistic community, did a lot of work around, you know, providing mental health resources to the artistic community in New York. And then when you do that with a sense of joy of like, oh, and we get to come out and enjoy the city again, that realness, that pairing, I think worked really well.
It was absolutely brilliant. And thank you for reminding me about the most important somehow aspect of this was that all the performers on Broadway were suffering so. Not only giving them this opportunity, but providing that 360, those mental health services that as a brand, you do stand for, you are tapped into, and you are bringing full circle to the minds of all consumers, as well as providing resources for those that need that. But now I do want to go back in time a little bit. I want to understand how you learned to do all this. I may know a little bit more than people listening because we have had these conversations, but I was inspired from day one. I think we had a really great chat when we first met, and you shared some really wonderful stories with me. So can you first sort of tell us a little bit about where you're from and when you were growing up, who some of your influences were, and what were the kinds of things you were thinking about or dreaming about?
I grew up in really rural North Carolina, grew up with hippie parents who had moved us way out into the country to live off the land. And we had a farm that was all kinds of things throughout the year. It's currently a sheep farm, but it was a million different things. When you grow up on a farm, everyone thinks it's so idyllic. Everyone's like, oh, that's so romantic. I can tell you now it was not at all.
Right. Up at the crack of dawn, right. doing chores, doing the things.
But I was one of those really odd kids who probably around age 15 knew what she wanted to do. I played like four sports in high school. I loved it. And I had my room covered in Nike posters. And around that time, it was the era of, if you remember, like the If You Let Me Play spots and the Charles Barkley, I'm Not a Role Model.
Yes. Actually, I was working with Nike at the time, teaching our storytelling workshops when that campaign was being created. And I saw the first early video and I was weeping in the back of the room. So that's how much older I am than you. You were 15 and I was not, but there you go.
I was weeping in my own 15-year-old way. I can still quote you things from that If You Let Me Play spot, like, I'll be more likely to leave a man who beats me. I remember being like, oh my gosh, they went there and they said that, and I want to play sports because of that. And I just remember thinking, like, Nike doesn't just sell, it's not about shoes and shirts, it's about culture and it's about truth and it's about speaking truth to power sometimes. And I was like, ah, that's what I want to do. And so I went to college at UNC. I majored there in the journalism school. Every summer I would write a letter to Wieden and Kennedy begging them to give me an internship. They never responded. It got to be my senior year, and I think I'd gotten a job at BBDO working on Pizza Hut as like the lowest of the low assistant executive. I'm sure it was like the tiniest job, but I remember talking to my professor and he was like, what are you doing? Like, you have always wanted to go work on Nike. Don't, yes, that's a great job, but don't do that. Go do your dream. And I remember him saying to me, you're only 22 once. Like, this is the one time, like, you don't make any money now anyway. Go and do it.
I love that guy.
John Sweeney, Professor Sweeney, so good. And anyway, long story short, I ended up taking the plunge, moving out there, showing up, basically asking to speak to Dan Wieden. And they were like, who are you? And I was like, I'm here to make culture and change the world. And they thought I was so crazy that they gave me a job that day. And
Incredible.
I was with Wieden and Kennedy for about 10 years. And it was an amazing place to grow up from a career perspective, just because it taught me so much around creativity, how to really shape an idea, how to keep it protected. Like, there was a lot of talk there around no one cares how many sacrifices you had to make to get it there or how hard it was. They're just going to look at the final work and if it's good or not. So your job is to get it, make it good.
What a great lesson. Wow.
And there's just so much desire to and ambition to be brave and to make stuff that really makes people think. And so I think I was raised with that thought of, like, it's not just enough to sell something. You need to actually make people feel, you need to make people. So I did that in Portland and I did it in Amsterdam.
I mean, 10 years.
Yeah, a long time.
And in Europe as well as the States, that's an incredible journey in and of itself. Some people would just be fortunate enough to just have that, but it didn't stop there.
Well, I worked a bunch on Nike when I was at Wieden. I got to do that, but I'd also worked on Target and Electronic Arts. But after 10 years, I really was like, I need to go work for Nike. I really want to go do that. So I jumped over to Nike, which was amazing. I was there for 7 years and I had a lot of jobs at Nike. I feel really grateful for the journey I had there. I started out in the brand innovation team and that was really around marketing innovations 3 to 5 years out. So how do we do fast customization? You know, how do we create women's product that doesn't try to suppress their body, but really like embraces their body?
You know, what a concept. Yes.
From there, I worked in marketing. So I worked in for Nike Women's, Nike Sportswear. And then my last couple of years there, I worked in what I would have called a startup within Nike called Digital Sport. And at the time, it was all around, it was Nike Plus Running. So tracking your athletic activity in order to make you better. I ran Nike Plus Running for a while. And then I helped launch Nike Fuel Band and worked on our member services programs. And
all the cool stuff.
It was amazing. It was great. And with Nike, like, I think with every job, you kind of learn different things. Like with Nike, I really learned how to create 360 marketing, not just an ad campaign, but really how you weave something through. Nike talked a lot around how to prioritize. Don't just do a bunch of little things. Do one big thing and make it pow. That has stuck with me a lot too since then. from there, let's see. I'll skip over this part because it always makes people jealous. We quit and we took a year traveling around the world with our kids.
So most people think that is like career suicide.
Yeah, totally.
Especially probably at that time. Today, I think people think very differently about those things. And we would find more and more people taking that opportunity to do that. But I, you know, would just love to have you talk just a minute about how you thought about that. And I know you pretty well. I don't think you say, you get up in one morning and say, hey, let's go tomorrow to, you know, take a year off our lives and travel the world. I mean, how did you think about that? And what was on your mind at the time on the side of maybe why not to do it versus why to do it?
Yeah, that's such a good question. You know, because in a lot of ways, I think I could have easily have been at Nike for all my life. There's so many opportunities there. And I love it. I always have.
Yes.
At the time, let's see, there are a couple of things going on. My husband's parents are Debbie and Michael Campbell, and they're called the Senior Nomads. They're actually famous because they have been traveling for 8 years, staying in Airbnbs, and they become this icon for how to retire on a budget but live really well. And Airbnb discovered them maybe 2 years into them doing this, and like, they've done every cool thing. Like, they've lived the internship, like where they've gone done a summer internship with Brian Chesky, to like, they've written books, you know, they've come and spoken at all the Airbnb conferences. And we would get on the phone with them every week, and they would be like, oh yeah, we're in Israel right now. And they would like tell us a story. And we'd be like,
you're like, oh my God, our life, it's good, but it's a little boring, right?
That's exactly it. And they'd be like, what are you guys up to? And we're like, we were with the kids in the backyard last night. And not that that's a bad thing, but
of course,
we were getting jealous. And then we realized we want to do this. When would we do it? And we were like, well, maybe we'll wait till we're retired. And that felt so long. And so we started coming up with this idea we called Project Halftime, which was like, hey, we're about halfway through our careers. Let's take a break and let's do this. And it was
only Jenny Campbell would actually brand
That's right.
what you're doing. Project Halftime.
That's right.
In a sports
it needs
context.
A handle. Yeah.
Yes. Please continue.
To make it ourselves feel better.
I
needed to be branded.
I love that. That is amazing.
And let's see, my husband at the time was kind of MDing an agency there. So that was really hard. I was at Nike. It was a bit of a shock and awe moment, but our kids were 8 and 10. We knew if we didn't do it then, it would be really hard when they were teenagers. They may not want to hang out with us. So we just did it. And you're exactly right. It is a little scary. You have exactly those fears of like, will anyone hire me again? I'm leaving. Like, is this smart? This doesn't feel smart. And then you all of a sudden are in a position where you just see your checking account just go down, down, down throughout an entire year. And that's slightly terrifying. But, you know, you're so right that what I found, I was so surprised, is that it actually, I think, made me more marketable in a weird way. Like, everyone mm-hmm. wanted to hear my story. And everybody who would do an interview with me, we'd spend 45 minutes talking about the year and about 15 minutes talking about the job. I'd be like, hey, actually, I want to hear about that job we were going to talk about.
Right. Yeah. I just have to ask, what was your favorite stop along the way in that year?
Oh, there's so many. It's such a hard question. But I would say that Asia was amazing for our family. First of all, for a Caucasian family living in Portland, it was really good for my kids, I think, to feel like what it felt like to be the minority. They felt really out of place. And I was glad for it. And, you know, everything was different there. But like, the culture there is amazing. And traveling around there and meeting the people there. And we would dress Spencer up, who was my 8-year-old at the time, in local soccer jerseys. And that's how we would meet people. Because if they wore like the local soccer club, someone would talk to us and we would make friends. And Asia, I thought, was pretty game changing for us as a family.
That's really inspiring. Beautiful risks for the kids, actually. I would imagine today, if we asked them, they were at ages where they must remember almost everything.
The things that stick out to them, ironically, are the things when things went wrong. Talk about perfectly imperfect.
Of course. Of course.
I'm like, don't you remember all the good things? They're like, do you remember that time our plane left without us? I'm like, yes, but...
That's so good. So I'm not really trying to do like a resume read here, but I think people would be interested in knowing, where did you land right after that?
Well, it's interesting. When you're traveling, you kind of get unstuck. We had actually planned to go back to Portland, but about 6 months in, you start to just be much more open. And every city you'd get in that you thought was cool, you'd be like, oh, what would it be like to work here? And your mind opens up. And I had gotten a call for a job, and I called a friend of mine, Glenn Cole, who runs 72 and Sunny. He's the founder here in LA. And I said, "Hey, Glenn, I got this call. Is this place even any good?" I was just kind of feeling him out. And he went, "Why are you looking?" And I went, "No, I'm just asking." And he went, "Why? Because I've got like three jobs. You should come do these." And at that point, he wanted me to run a production company, which I had never done. I'm not a producer. But the entrepreneurial aspect of it was really interesting to me, the business side of it. So I ended up coming on. We just decided to move to LA, which was great for us. And I ended up being the MD at 72 and Sunny for about 2 years, which again, when you learn things in every job, what I learned there was like how to run a business. It was like a business degree on just like how you do that. And it was great. In some ways, it was hard to be back on the agency side. Agency life is hard. You know, you're much more at someone else's beck and call. It feels a little bit more out of control.
Any of these service businesses, we're in them. It is hard.
If I'm going to be at any of them, 72 is a great one to be at. But I remember kind of getting the call from Ellie Seidman, who was the CEO of Tinder at the time. And I remember thinking, oh, that's interesting. I love working on brands that are, number one, I love youth culture brands. And I like brands that have really shaped culture and have a little edge to them.
Yes.
And when I think about Tinder, that is a rite of passage for every young person around the globe. And the idea of getting to work in tech was really exciting. And I had this conversation with Ellie. He was very inspiring. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it. And I was at Tinder for 2 years as a CMO there. It was a global role. So I got to really do a lot of marketing in the North America, but also it's such a great strategic challenge to figure out how to talk about dating in Indonesia, which has a very different culture than Brazil.
Right. I can only imagine. Wow. A lot of learning, though, very, very quickly. But you had just come off a year of traveling in Asia and a number of... So I want everybody to understand who's listening. The dots connect for people. It's just... doesn't always look like it, but the dots really do connect. But sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, it was a great couple of years. I learned a lot about performance marketing, you know, and I didn't have as much of that in my career before Tinder. I learned a lot of even just like brand marketing, because Tinder is such an amazing brand and how you build that in a really seamless way. And then I think I was pretty happy there and you called me. You were like, "Hey, Jenny."
As I recall, that was pretty much what happened. Like yesterday, I really do remember the first conversation, and it had nothing to do with me. You loved the brand. You loved Kate Spade. So that was just so beautiful and such a wonderful surprise. I think you told me that Kate Spade might have been the brand of the first handbag that you really invested in when you were in maybe college or maybe high school. I can't remember, but it was one of those.
I remember when I graduated college and I got the job at Wieden and Kennedy, my mom was so proud of me because she had been really worried because I basically had gone cross country with no job. And she was like, "What is happening? You turned down a job in New York with money.
What is going on with my daughter?" Right.
What is this? And she bought me a Kate Spade purse because she was so proud of me. And I remember being really proud because, you know, when you're 22, you don't really know how you should look in a corporate environment. Not that Wieden was that corporate, but I remember being really proud of it. And I would come into meetings and I would actually sit it on the table versus under the table because I wanted everyone to see it. And
I love that.
I've always loved Kate Spade. To me, it's such a passion brand. It's just one of those brands. Everyone's got a story like mine, to be honest with you. Being in this role is... it's very different. Everyone also has a Tinder story. They're very different than Kate Spade stories. And I love to hear them so much.
When I found out that you had gone to Tinder, I sort of watched you for, that's what we do over here. So it's kind of strange. People don't realize that, but it's not like we just like leap on the phone and call somebody. We follow talent. It's what we do. And I remember thinking, what an interesting left or right turn that was, but bringing together, because had you not been in that digital kind of innovation role, what was digital marketing innovation at the time? And had you probably not run all of those new products around running, you probably would not have understood enough about technology, and correct me if I'm wrong, and building community. Because what I felt was what the fashion industry needed to really learn about and understand was one part, bringing digital or media to the center of a brand, consumers to the center, but also how to build communities. And if Tinder's not a community, I don't know what is in some ways. Does any of this resonate? And what about all of that was helpful coming into Kate Spade, of course, in addition to your 10 years at Wieden, your time at Nike, et cetera?
You're exactly right around how things tend to kind of breadcrumb throughout your career. So either there's a pattern that catches or something about the roles that you just like and you keep gravitating to. And that idea of digital community and fostering that has definitely been a thread for me. I find myself always gravitating towards brands who have a really strong community. So at Nike, we had a really huge running community when I was leading Nike Plus Running. And we did a lot of talking around, like, how do we make sure that they feel the love from us? How do we connect them with each other? You want to keep people running because it's healthy. It's like your job is to keep people active. And community was a big unlock to that. Because I'm sure you can imagine that it's much easier to run when you have a friend who's going to show up at your doorstep and be like, hey,
kidding.
We're getting out there.
No kidding. 25 years as a runner, I can tell you that is 1,000% true. I hated running. I am air quoting for those of you who can't see me until I started working with Nike, and it's just contagious. So
a lot of the job was like, how do you take those things that we know that happens in the physical world, you know, where like a friend literally comes to your door, but like, how do you do it digitally? How do you create those leaderboards that you feel like if I don't run today, someone's going to see it, or I really want to be like in the top five of my leaderboard? Or there's just a lot of accountability, and then also just a lot of joy of like giving people high fives. You know, like with Nike Plus, if you give someone a heart while they're running, you hear a clapping in your headphones and you're like, it's like 5 a.m. You're like, amazing. So a lot of that thinking definitely came into Tinder because it is a community experience. So at Tinder, one of the things we did together there was build this thing called Swipe Night, this choose your own adventure where you use the Tinder swiping mechanism, the left and right, to choose your way through a story. And then at the end, you get paired with other people who also made the same choices as you as the story. And this idea of like building community, bringing people together, giving people things to talk about so it's easier to connect, definitely has a thread from Nike Plus days. And then when I think about Kate Spade, one of the things I love most about the brand is it has a very, very engaged community. Like, people love to hashtag us when they're wearing something that's Kate Spade. We have a novelty group that is wonderful and that they love our novelty bags so much. They know the product better than our designers. Like, they have been tracking it for years. They've been collecting it for years. And when you have that type of love, I think your job as a marketer is to lean into that and make that really your focus, you know, how you take care of them back.
That's such a great example. And thank you for drawing those connections. I want to talk to you a little bit about leadership, but before I do, is digital today, or is it something else? I know we're all, of course, talking about the metaverse of the future, but I mean, right this moment in time, how do you think about the digital of where Nike Plus was and Fuel Band versus when you even stepped into Kate Spade with this highly digital consumer? I mean, what's changing? And is it still digital or is it something else now?
It's an interesting question because I think digital is like water now. It is. It's not a separate thing. It's just it's how you connect with people because that's how we connect with each other. And so I think that's why you hear so much in the conversation either now around storytelling, because people are realizing it's not about creating good assets for digital. It's like making the right stories for each platform, because each platform is slightly different, right? And the things that you go to TikTok for are slightly different than what you go to Pinterest for and slightly different than Instagram. And so it's much more around how you build connections, and digital is kind of just your tool. For me, though, when I think about what I get excited about for digital, I'm going to assume that the performance marketing is going to do its thing. Go for it.
Right.
You can't, need to have it. And we do really well in this. The things I get excited about are using digital to meet her where she is. I don't know if you saw recently the whole Emily in Paris, the instantly shoppable fashion. The fashion in that show is amazing. And the idea of like, I'm watching something, I'm excited by it, and I want to learn about it, get it right now. I don't want to have to then go to your site and figure it out. I just want it to happen. The instantaneousness of meeting them where they are, I think, is in weaving yourself into those moments versus asking her to come to you, I think is really where we're all building to.
It's interesting. So I have an experience doing that myself. Does it interrupt the experience of the programming, or is it being done really well? And you're talking about it, so you must feel good about it. How How do you think about that right now?
You know, I think it's becoming more and more seamless. There's some janky bits, but again, I applaud them because when you're a first and doing innovation, that's okay. That's part of it. You know, we've been trying some things on a different scale where we've been doing live stream and having live stream on Facebook and YouTube and having you be able to instantly buy right there. I was expecting that to be janky because again, we're beta-ing things. It was super seamless, super quick. We actually saw great business results and it was fun from a brand standpoint. So I really want our team to continue to try that because I think that that's really, it makes it easy for people. You don't want them to have to think about it too much. You want to meet them where they are.
Yes, and spontaneous anything right now, but particularly the best shopping is when you just see something, you love it and you buy it. Or you, if you're me, you see something, you love it, you might sleep on it overnight, but then you will buy it. So, but it is that thing that just gets you right there.
And I think Kate Spade has such emotional product. Like people see our product and they have this feel of like, oh, I must have that. And I think that that lends itself really well to something like this.
That's brilliant. Any other trends you're seeing that you would want to share?
You know, I think every, you know, marketer in this space is trying to figure out really how to show up well on TikTok. Everybody knows to show up and we're all doing it. But how you do it right, I think is still part of the conversation. And I'll speak for us, like what we're trying to do is figure out how to be aspirational, but still be relatable and how to let our community tell our story. There's a creativity in that and really embracing that creativity and that authenticity. It takes a bravery to do that because I think fashion would much prefer to have things be controlled and have things look very perfect.
Yes.
And with TikTok and things like that, you kind of have to let go of that and you have to embrace the enthusiasm and the love of the product and story much more so than the perfection.
And it is an incredible platform just for joy and having fun and doing a dance when you can't leave your house or whatever it is. So what a perfect connection. Segueing into the topic of leadership, do you have any leadership values, if you will, that are really personal to you that you would want to share?
Your leadership changes over the course of your career and you learn along the way. And I feel like I'm a really different leader than maybe I was in other parts of my career. And a big shift happens, I think, when you go from being an individual contributor to being a leader of a team, because the things that get rewarded when you're an individual contributor are just different. Your leadership there, you're looked at as like, is she bold? Does she have good ideas? Can she make things happen? And those things are still true when you get into a team situation, but they shift slightly, you know? And so for me, I focus a lot on how do we paint a really clear vision of what we want a brand to be, where we want to go, how we're going to get there. And then the second thing is, it's all about the team and it's all about the people. And it's less about you doing it yourself, but you creating an environment where good work can happen. And so I spend a lot of time, more so than I ever have in other jobs, of just like, how do you organizationally set yourself up? How do you create psychological safety so that you can have healthy debate? Because good creative requires debate.
That is so important.
We should talk about that because that's a tricky thing.
And let's go there. Yes.
Yeah. I will say, I think Kate Spade has one of the nicest cultures I've ever been part of. I jokingly say I've never used as many exclamation points as I have in my life ever. It's a lovely, but one of the things I found when I first came on is that debating felt like criticizing. It didn't happen as much. And so you have to create an environment where people feel okay to do it. And they can also do it respectfully. You have to know how to debate. Right?
Yes.
Because if you think about it, creative ideas are really fragile. And when a creative presents something to you, it's a really personal thing. It's an idea that they've thought of that might be really small and unformed yet. And you don't want to squash it before it's had a chance to do it. So for our teams, we've been talking a lot around what does good feedback look like? When is the right time to give good feedback? What size group should that feedback be given in? Because I think you can debate at both sides.
How much?
How much?
Who should be in the room?
Yeah.
What the timing is?
That's right. You've been in your career as long as I have, you start to learn some of those things intuitively. But if you're coming up in your 20s and you haven't learned it, like that's
right. That works in life as well. I mean, that just bleeds right over.
You know, it's so funny that you say that. I feel like I bring a lot of my parenting skills to this job all the time too, where I'm like, just ask powerful questions. Don't tell them the answer. Just ask powerful questions.
I vaguely remember using that in my lifetime with my kids. Indeed.
But I think you need the debate And you need that creative tension to get to good work. Otherwise, you're just going to get work that's one-dimensional and that everybody likes. Because I think what you want to get to is work that has a little bit of, if I were at Nike, I would have said like truth-telling and controversy. And you're kind of like, you're the one who puts your finger on the issue and are brave enough to talk about it. With Kate, I think it's more about, how do you be really real? How do you speak truth? And especially if we're going to be about enabling joy, how do you bring joy to life in the right way that people can really feel an honesty from?
This is so fresh. And I don't think anyone in 18 months of doing this podcast has ever talked about this. And it's so incredibly important. All of us, of course, are sensitive and we're sensitive in different ways, but you're so right about creatives and when they, we, whoever, I mean, all of us has a certain amount of creativity, but when they own the burden or the joy of coming up with the ideas, how we feed that back is everything. It can really damage people if it's not considered in the right way. So I spent 20 years of my career working with creatives and helping them with storytelling and presenting their ideas to people like you might have been at Nike in previous years, and what that challenge and that debate is like. So can you say just a little bit about what that journey has been like? I mean, maybe going a little bit further on that at Kate Spade and with the team.
What I would tell anybody on my team is your job is to make the best creative work on the planet and to have an amazing consumer experience. You have a huge responsibility to our consumer to make sure that she feels the love of our brand and we show up in the right way for her. When you orient your feedback with those things in mind, your feedback is different. So it becomes less about, I don't like this, subjective. It becomes, oh, what if we did this to make it stronger? You're in the mode of making it stronger versus being right. You have to get out of the mode of like who's right and wrong, because creatives, it's not black and white like that. It's more nuanced. And so we talk a lot as a team around asking powerful questions versus giving feedback, giving space for people to really try to articulate their idea, because sometimes creative ideas, especially in the beginning, like, you don't have a snappy handle yet. You just kind of have a feeling. And I would say too, like, again, when you give feedback, it is about how you make it cut through more or what would make it stronger. And that it's not always perfect. We still make all kinds of, I make all kinds of mistakes, but it helps those guardrails.
So when you think about the leaders that you've worked with and for, who have either directly mentored you or might not have known it, but you were watching them and learning from them, and some of those either snippets or longer memories have really stuck with you. And what did you learn?
I will say that so much of who I am today really started with Wyden and Kennedy. And I would jokingly say it was kind of like, you know, we were talking being raised by wolves. It was kind of a crazy party environment. Like, I would not survive today by any means.
I love that.
But, you know, Dan Wyden and David Kennedy were still there when I was there. And I learned a lot about giving creative feedback because creatives ruled the roost at Wyden and Kennedy. And you better be strategic if you're going to show up in a room and have feedback. If you're going to open your mouth, you better make it count. So I learned
Amazing.
A lot about that.
Love them for that.
Me too. And I also learned about the fragility of creative. And again, what your job is to protect. But more than anything, like, they were also as amazing as they were and are, they were very humble. And it was about don't act big. That was actually one of the sayings we had up on the wall, like, don't act big. Your work speaks for itself. Put your head down and do the job. And
so good.
That to me, I still get really annoyed with big egos. I don't have much patience for them because it's just like, just do your job and do it well and you'll be fine.
Everything will work out.
Exactly. Right? And I think I learned a lot from them on that. They also had a big thing up on the wall. I think they still do. It said fail harder way before Zuckerberg's break things and go fast. But it was all about like, you have to have the courage to take big swings and sometimes you're going to strike out. They took the fear out of that. It gets scarier as you get more senior because more is at stake, if I'm being really honest. But I really try to remind myself of that a lot because you don't do a very good job if you play scared.
You just made me think about something, and this will sound quite contrived, I think, because I think most people know this about leaders cross-culturally, across industries, but athletes tend to make very good leaders. Do you think that's true?
Yes. Being a sports fan, I would say so for sure. You know, the thing with athletes that you learn is team. And you learn how to have people play in their positions and get the best out of their positions. You learn how to motivate and you learn how to build people up. So I just learned this tip about a year ago as I came into this Kate Spade job, but it reminds me a little bit of when I played sports, and I'll come back to the connection. But they said, hey, when someone's learning something new, you need 75% of your feedback should be really positive and 25% should be constructive, because you're really fragile when you're learning something new, right? So you need that psychological safety of like, hey, it's okay and cool. You might want to try this. Hey, it's okay and cool. You might, or when someone really does do a good job on something that's hard for them, like shower them with love. And I think about that a lot with sports of just like, you've got a coach like Friday Night Lights, Coach Taylor, he's all up in your grill constantly, like yes. telling you to like yes. get your head out of wherever and play. But then when you do well, he has got you. I think some of that coaching and knowing what it takes to be on a team like that comes through in a work environment too.
As many of you know, we have resisted the notion of paid sponsorships so that we can use these in-between moments to share people, organizations, and social impact initiatives that we believe are so important and driving change around the world. It is in this spirit that we wanted to share Harlem's Fashion Rose new nonprofit, which we are excited to contribute to and to share with you. Systemic barriers, financial, racial, and social, have existed in the fashion industry since its inception. This has caused talented creators to be overlooked, leading to decades of missed opportunity and marginalization. For 14 years, Harlem's Fashion Row, better known as HFR, has created a bridge between Black designers and retailers through collaborations, pipeline programs, and experiential events. In 2020, HFR launched a 501c3 nonprofit, Icon 360, to address systemic barriers and COVID challenges Black designers face. Their mission is to provide fashion designers of color with resources for sustainable business growth and legacy development. In 2020, Icon 360 received a generous donation of $1 million from the CFDA and Vogue. This donation was a business lifeline for over 25 Black designers. Later this year, Icon 360 will launch an endowment campaign. HFR invites retailers to join them in changing the course of fashion by creating a new legacy. This important endowment will ensure that Black fashion designers will be seen, heard, and supported for generations through your support. Please go to www.hfricon360.com for more details. Thank you.
What is it like now leading in a period of our history where people have a growth mindset, I think, right now, and people is a generalization, but many people have a growth mindset, but it might not be matching what a company believes your growth mindset should look like. I know you know what I'm talking about, but how I want to work, how I want to show up to work, how much I want to be in the office, how much I want to be with my family, how I want to grow as a person, having been home with my family or home without my family, home alone, or fortunately finding friends to create a pod with and finding the joy in that. What is it like to be a leader right now? I mean, I can tell you some of the things I'm experiencing, but it's not about me today. But what's that like for you?
When I took this job, as you know, I live in Los Angeles. The job was in New York. And I have kids who are now in high school, and it was going to be really hard for me to uproot them to come to New York. And I remember having conversations with our CEO, and you were with me with this, where I was like, hey, I don't want to jerk your chain. I just want to be really upfront in the beginning that, like, if that's a deal breaker, as much as I love this and I want this job, I can't do that right now. And I remember Liz saying to me, who Again, I could not say enough nice, awesome things about Liz. She's so good.
She is amazing. I would echo them all day.
She's amazing. So I remember her saying, you know, Jenny, if you'd asked me that 2 years ago, I would have said, no way, it has to be here. She goes, but with everything happening right now, I think let's go for it. Let's try it. And what I have found for myself, I get up, I work a New York day. I get up at 4. I don't make a big deal out of it. I just work a New York day. And we all connect so well on Zoom. I do find with Zoom, you have to over emote. You have to really put your phone aside. You need to look people in the eye. You cannot do the multitasking thing. You need to probably give even more emotionally than you might otherwise, because it's like having one of your senses taken off. You got to kind of use the other senses. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, I think people have realized that there's so much flexibility in that, and that you can work from anywhere and have that be a good thing. That being in the office, in some way, it is nice to have creative brainstorms all together, or it is nice to see someone be like, oh, you, that's right. I want to tell you this thing. The spontaneity of some of those is nice, but to be able to do most jobs, it's not reliant on it. And so for us as leaders, we've talked a lot as a leadership team around how do we enable flexibility? There are some jobs that you have to be in person for. A producer on a shoot, you got to be at the shoot. But there are a lot of jobs that don't. And how do you just provide flexibility and focus on the job versus the environment of the job is a lot of the conversations that we've had, you know? Or how do you pick your moments to come together?
The job, not the environment. I mean, that's a great point.
I actually think Zoom, in some ways, I call it the great equalizer. Everybody's got the same shape box on the screen, whether you're a CEO or someone who's entry level coming in. And there is something about that that actually lends itself sometimes to hard discussions, where sometimes in the same room, they may feel differently. And so when you instead just focus on like, what are you trying to accomplish? And how do you make sure that everybody has a voice versus we're not in person? You just put that aside. I think you can actually get the same result.
I was speaking to somebody not too long ago who's working for a giant global company and said they were trying to think about coming together as the carrot, not the stick.
We talk about that too, because it's like there are moments where it feels so great to get to have everybody all together, and they can be real energy gives. And then there's moments to let people go and have that flexibility and know that they're going to do their job well, whether they're sitting at the desk beside you or sitting in their own home on that. To me, I think the harder challenge as all of us come back into the office in varying degrees is the hybridness, you know, because like all digital, I think actually works pretty well. All in person, I think we know how that works. The in-between is a little trickier, and I think that's going to be hard for us to adjust to.
Like who comes in on what days and how do you...
Or just half the room being on screen, half of them being in person, because to that conversation we were just having around like the great equalizer, all of a sudden it's not equal again. Someone's a small box on a screen and everybody there is having a side conversation in the room.
Is there anything else before I move away from this about this moment in time? I'm hearing a lot about pent-up demand and business seems to be pretty good out there for brands if they could just get product in the hands of the consumer. The supply chain issues continue to plague everyone. Anything else about right now?
With the right now, it's all about nimbleness. And the companies and the brands that can be nimble are winning. Because I think about even just with the supply chain issues that all of us have been experiencing, Kate Spade's no stranger from that either. You have to make a plan, get information, remake the plan again, do it again. And you have to be able to hold on to the good parts of the plan and still be really confident enough to move around the other things. And that can just, from a pure exhaustion standpoint, just be hard on the teams. What I think, if I think about the good side of that, is I think it's teaching people to, number one, you have to have a growth mindset because things are not fixed.
If we don't know that by now, those who didn't before, yeah, things will change.
You really do. And you have to be okay with understanding that just because it didn't go a way it meant to it intentionally doesn't mean that the next option is the wrong option. It's just a different way to do it. And I think being that open to being able to change and pivot has probably been the muscle all of us have built over this last year and a half.
So just looking toward the future a little bit, how do you think about leading the brand alongside Liz and the team going forward, and anything we should be looking for with, you know, Kate Spade on the Move or any of the other great platforms that you're building or any of the cause related work that is exciting to you going forward that you would want everybody to know about?
You know, when I think about Kate Spade, and one of the big reasons I love working there, it's a very values-driven brand. So it has an amazing brand purpose, which is joy colors life. So a lot of our conversations are around how do we enable joy? What a great mission to be able to be part of. And I see Liz with her entire leadership team challenging us to think like that. Okay, that's awesome. You're going to do that. How does that enable joy? How does that create a better consumer experience? We talk a lot about the consumer, you know, like how can we show up for her? If we are a community oriented brand, what does that mean? Okay, let's orient first towards taking care of the community and we'll do the other part second, you know, and
yes,
those kind of things feel really good from just a building block standpoint. And then it's just, I will say, it's so fun to be at Kate right now. The product is just looking amazing. Our leadership team is, Liz has done a pretty impressive job of building out a very, very strong leadership team where everybody has come because they love the brand and because they get excited about what's ahead. And so like the product is really fun up thing. I think for myself, I'm going to be looking more and more globally. Coming in my first year, I focused a lot on North America, just getting like the brand vision solidified and organized. And now it's like, how do we really start to get that strength again globally? So there's a lot there as well.
Very, very exciting. I cannot thank you enough. And before closing, is there anything else that you would want to say here?
Oh, Karen, it's just been such a joy to get to have the last couple of years, I guess the last year and a half of getting to know you. You know, sometimes when you meet someone and you're like, yeah, I'm going to know her for a long time. I'm really excited to get to be on this journey with you. And thank you so much for having me.
I really appreciate you to know. And these relationships are what I get out of bed every morning for, and to support great people and really great work. So congratulations on that. And thank you.
Thanks to you too, Karen.
Thank you so much for listening. And I hope you enjoyed our program. You can subscribe to Fashion Tech Forum in the Studio wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Fashion Tech Forum in the Studio is a production of FTF and Charts and Leisure, co-produced by my amazing co-founder of FTF and Index, Maya Wojcik, and Megal Janardin of Charts and Leisure. The program is executive produced by Jason Oberholzer and me, and our theme music was written and performed by the wonderful Michael Simonelli. Thank you again for joining Fashion Tech Forum in the Studio, and I look forward to seeing you soon.